Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 180th edition of the Frank and Stan chat. And again, as those who watch this as a video will notice that at the bottom of my screen, and I think yours as well, there's Tracy O'Brien. Hello, Tracy.
Hi, Tracy.
Hi, good morning. Hi, yeah. Stan. Hi, Frank.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I think Tracy and I think we've only met once face to face, and that was in London, I think, last September. But Trace got an interesting story, and some of that is around influences some of my sort of previous work and some of Stan's previous work. So before we get into introducing Tracy a bit more, just ask Stan, you all right this week? Everything fine?
Yeah.
No illnesses?
No illnesses, no. A slight pranging of my wife's car yesterday.
Were you responsible for that?
Yeah.
Oh.
Totally.
It's one of those where really you can't do anything but own up to that, can you, really?
Well, not when she was sat in the car with me.
Was it just a slight little bump?
It's a slight scrape down the side of the car.
Oh.
On your side or her side? On the...
Her side. Trying to get through a gate that wasn't quite wide enough.
Right. Air was blue or
not blue, quiet.
Quiet. Oh yeah, that's. I have to say, when Ali, my wife, is quiet, that's not a good place to be. Anyway, Tracy, do you want to just introduce yourself for those people who are perhaps not familiar with your work and what you're currently doing?
Yeah, hi. My name's Tracy O'Brien. I'm currently a head teacher of a school in South London. I've worked in education for, goodness me, I think it's exactly 30 years now. I'm a geography teacher, so I absolutely love geography and that it sort of hits all the world issues that we face. And I'm a real advocate of the humanities in our education system. I've done most roles, so I hope that I have quite a good understanding of all the different elements of how, you know, things that you do at school impacts on different people at different levels. I've always been interested in the impact of what we do and measuring impact. So I think, you know, I've always kind of followed the teaching and learning route, CPD. I've done quite a lot of work back in the sort of the 2000s with London Challenge, supporting schools. I was an advanced skills teacher. I did a bit of work with David Woods and Tim Brighouse around sort of London Challenge and supporting schools. And I'm really, really always sort of passionate about stuff that you do for a purpose, which is around the learners and the staff and the families. And a couple of years ago, I sort of took that to my word, and I wrote a book about school self-review, Sensible School Self-Review, because I was absolutely guilty in the past of being obsessed with evidence and folders and making sure there was a form for everything before the days of Microsoft Forms. They're all on paper. And I collected them all sort of religiously. And I thought it was great. You know, I thought that, you know, me collecting all this evidence about what we did was brilliant. And of course, it was exhausting. It was exhausting for me, but more importantly, it was exhausting for all my peers who had to hand all this stuff in. So I had a complete sort of change. And actually, it was instigated by an Ofsted visit, where the inspector sort of came into my office and saw all the shiny folders. And I was like, awfully proud. I was like, look at all the work I've done and the evaluation of every single thing. And she just shook her head and she was just like, and she was really sound. But she said to me, okay, so you're in charge of teaching and learning at CPD. Let's go and see a maths A-level lesson. I did maths A-level, but a long time ago.
Right.
So I was like, oh no, how am I going to judge a maths A-level lesson? And she said, if you agree with what I say, then I will trust everything you said about the teaching and learning quality in this school. And I was like, oh my gosh. Wow. So we walked across to the lesson. I've got to say, I was probably quite terrified because it really did land on me. I was the deputy head for teaching and learning. The lesson was hard. I can't even remember what it was on, but it was smashing. You know, it was really, really smashing. The kids were really engaged. And I came out and I thought, oh, what am I going to go for? Am I going to go for good? Am I going to go for outstanding? And I came out and I said, you know, I thought that was a brilliant lesson. It had really outstanding features. And before I finished the sentence, she said, oh, stop being so churlish. It was a great, fantastic lesson. I think we both agree. Right. I believe you.
Right.
And that was it. And I thought, okay, my folders are irrelevant now, because she pitched it correctly, I think, which was about professional dialogue, trust in professionals, a nice bit of common sense. And I thought, yeah, okay. So I wrote the book about self-review. And every single time I went to write something, Ofsted came up. Top-down accountability, pressure on schools, why people like me were collecting all of this nonsense in the first place. And so then last year I had to write the book about Ofsted.
Ofsted,
So, yeah,
which
and
is
it's
called
called.
Rethinking School Inspection.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I found what was so nice reading that book was the emphasis you placed on self-evaluation. And in a way, the story you've given there is perhaps
Yeah.
indicative of, I think for somebody who, I created the self-evaluation form, which was actually just a paper form and then went online, and oh, Stan's going to some, he's going to dig out a copy here now. But it was really just meant to be a very short statement about, what the general view of the school was about itself, identify a few areas that you're currently working on and why. But there we
That's
are.
because I appear in it.
But actually, that
Longer
seems to
than
me
that.
the start. I mean, as your book indicates, that seems to be the best starting point where schools are able to sort of make a statement, an opening gambit with an inspection team as to this is where we are. Not with, and I think what happened is when the self-evaluation form was introduced, it became more like an academic exercise to make sure that, oh, you've got to use this word, or you've got to use that word, or there's a big emphasis on this. So perhaps we ought to, instead of it just being an evaluation of how effective the school was. And I think that's where it lost its way. And I think it was sad when Michael Gove decided, as part of its reducing the burden on schools, that he got rid of it. Actually, self-evaluation is still there. I go into schools and people are still keen for me to have a quick look at their self-evaluation statement. But it is a shame that the inspection process doesn't incorporate that fully and have an expectation that it's there.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I love the SEF. Like you say, it does give you that opportunity to say, do you know what, we're working on these things. These things are going really well. These things we're not sure about, and we're trialing them or piloting them. And we've got some peer review sort of groups coming in to sort of help us tease out whether it's working. And actually, these things we know we really need to focus on. And I think you're right. I mean, I remember there was a whole kind of crew of professional SEF writers that were employed, which cost sort of consultancy money. So that was expensive for the school. It didn't really summarize probably what the school and the leadership and the sort of community thought about the school. And it also then ended up just regurgitating the framework. So, like you say about using keywords, it was, here's a writing frame, the framework. Let's put that in our school Seth with a couple of examples. But that's one of those unintended consequences thing, isn't it? I think that
I found having read hundreds of these, it feels like, in schools, that the one thing that was often missing was actually the evaluation. It was just regurgitating of the data, even though everybody had the data, so didn't need it all, but page after page after page, and then nothing. And my favourite one, I must say this, was a two, well, one form entry primary, a tiny school, 38 children in total. And the head said, I've got my husband's SEF and we're adapting it to our school. So I said, right, what does your husband do? He's a deputy head in a secondary school.
Oh dear. I mean, yeah, we'll get on to, I think we'll come back to inspection again, won't we, Tracy? I think in this discussion. But Stan, what's caught your eye this week?
Well, it's completely different from inspection. It's a case of wrongful dismissal, and a head teacher who won a case for wrongful dismissal. But I think it just raises some of the issues about teachers with their own children in school, And where does the boundary lie between being a parent and being a professional in the school? Because this teacher was dismissed, this head teacher rather, was dismissed for allegedly smacking her own child's hand at 6:30 in the evening in her office, because the child was spraying some fluid around. And it was reported by the DSL, who was in the room having had a meeting with the head teacher. And it was investigated by the police and by the local authority, who both said no case to answer. The trust decided that wasn't what they were going to do, and so they had an investigation and decided that it was assault, and assault was against the school regulations and statutory guidance and everything else, and so she was dismissed. But the judge has come up with some really interesting things, like, for instance, as a parent, she can use reasonable chastisement. And actually, as a teacher, she can physically stop some child harming themselves or others. And those are in the school policies. And yet the school was saying there's no physical contact at all allowed. Well, in their own policies, there clearly has to be. So they've, and it just made me wonder, why had they pursued a case which, in my view, would have been a conversation? I don't know. Once the police and the local authority have looked into it and said there is no assault, there is no case to answer, then I just wonder why people pursue it. But it did make me think, when I was a head, I definitely had teachers with children in our school, and you can look back in it and think, well, some handled that very well, and some didn't handle it quite as well as the others, and it's an additional burden. I just think there needs to be some clarity around within a school about how that arrangement is organised, and at what point you're the teacher and at what point you're the parent.
It's difficult to comment about that particular case, but it has triggered in my mind what used to do my head in. We used to have a code system on the front door, so staff could get in through the front door, but they would teach that some of the staff would tell their children what the code was. So I was finding the kids were coming in and they were then telling their friends what the code was. So everybody was using the code, you know? So there was no security whatsoever in the school. And actually, trying to pin that, I remember a conversation with a particular member of staff because I was convinced it was coming through this person. But she was adamant it wasn't. It was one of those where, you know, I was never going to win. And she was always going to defend it, you know. But actually, that's what it triggered in my mind as well about this sort of confusion that there sometimes can exist. Certainly did exist in that case where staff have got their children in the school, which is viewed as a positive thing, you know. I mean, lots of schools around here, private schools, give reduced fees if the children go to that school, you know. It's seen as a sort of sign of a recommendation of the quality of the place.
I can remember one of my staff with their child in the school, and he was amongst a group of three or four who were absolutely beautifully well-behaved, bright boys who never did anything wrong. And at one point, they got sent in by the welfare for up to something, so they were stood. The first thing one of them said was, "What do we do? Because we've never been in this situation before." This is about a 10-year-old. "I've never been in this situation before, Mr. Jones, so what do I do?" And then, so the three of them were there. So they ended up all crying. And mum comes in, hugs three of them,
That's a member of staff, a
deliberately
member of
misses her
staff.
child with a hug, with a look that you're in trouble later.
Okay, Tracy, what's caught your eye this week?
Well, just to sort of finish on that point, I think I sort of think two things. I used to work in a school when I was a deputy head where my daughter was in year seven. And it was a big school, so she was easily lost within that cohort. But she did used to kind of sneak in at break in to try and find my office where she wasn't really supposed to be for snacks. And I did have to say to her, "This is not on, you know. Not no other students are allowed in this part of the building." She's like, "Yeah, but I'm starving." I'm like, "Well, let's remember to pack your bag." So I had to kind of bat her off because I thought I can't be seen as, you know, the exception, and I didn't want her to have that kind of reputation either. So I was like, "Get out, you know, go and do your own thing." But going back to that, and obviously I can't talk about that case either, but I guess the thing is with the safeguarding thing, if you're the DSL, that's what you have to do, don't you? You have to. You're told to do that, you know. So whatever the circumstances are, you have got to do that. And I guess I remember an awful case of a parent's evening. So there wasn't the clash between it being a teacher parent, but at a parent's evening, one of the teachers says something to the parent, and the parent walloped the child in front of, you know, everybody in the hall. And so whatever that scale is, that the DSL is bound to report on everything, aren't they? And so
I
yes,
think my point is
it's
not so much the DSL,
yeah.
it's once the police and presumably the safeguarding team at the local authority have investigated it and found no action necessary,
Yeah.
that the trust then decide to push it further.
It's always what you don't know, isn't it, with all of this? You know, you just don't know the backstory. Tracy, what's caught your
So
eye?
yeah. So mine is today, obviously International Women's Day, but also the Big Listen. So one of the things that, you know, when I was doing the research for the book about rethinking inspection, I've got a very good friend of mine who's a deputy head in a special school in Belfast, and she would talk quite often about the inspectorate over there and the strikes and the lack of a government and all of the above. But there was a real strong movement from the profession, the education profession, that the inspection should halt until lots and lots of talks had gone on about reframing the entire process from sort of top to bottom and horizontally. And I thought that that was exactly what we needed. That, you know, there's so much. Last year, the year before, it got to the point where you just didn't want to hear the word. There was so much negativity about Ofsted. I guess some of the things that people liked about it were being swamped. And so one of the things that I've called out for, and many other groups and individuals, is can we please have a consultation about Ofsted? And actually, the Big Listen, I hope, could be the beginning of that. So I know it's probably due out today. I've read a, you know, a bit. There was stuff published at just gone midnight last night. I wasn't staying awake on purpose, but there were lots of stuff, you know, ready to press send. I've looked on the DfE website, you know, the government website. Schools Week have mentioned something. So it'll be really interesting to see what that consultation is about. There's a lot of what I've read which I'm not sure about, which is around what do parents say, what do parents want, what are parents going to feel about this. I know there's a lot of opportunity for student voice in there, and I know that Sir Martin Oliver is really keen on safeguarding disadvantaged, looking after vulnerable pupils. So I'm hoping that that really comes through. What I haven't seen yet, and it's probably purely because I haven't seen it, is what do schools get to talk about? You know, what are the questions for schools? I know that there's some questions around reporting, the process. There wasn't anything around the framework, I don't think, although there might have been something around getting people together to write the framework, which I think is a really good idea, a much bigger group of stakeholders and professionals to do that. So I'm really excited to see what that looks like, how many people contribute, because I hope it's lots and lots and lots, and then what happens with it. And I suppose, like all of these things, what will be a bit sad is it'll probably take ages, but you know, I think due process is such that it will. So that's got me interested today.
Stan, did you have a feel about this?
I just want it to have context in somewhere that not everybody is judged on the same, you know, by the same framework, yes, but not by the same standards, because there is a different context in schools. And I think somewhere that's got to be recognised.
I think Yeah, for me, having been involved in some of these in the past, I think it'd be fair to say Ofsted, and this is not recent, used to just do what it wanted to do. It used to consult and would find a way in which it would identify particular groups of respondents who were positive about something and emphasize that. So for example, you might end up with parents and carers being very positive about something and virtually every single school being opposed to it, but it, in its response would say, well, parents and carers are really supportive of this proposal, you know, so in effect had a very clear idea. It was, I think, a Frankenstein chat. Are very fortunate in September we've got a guy called John Mallin who's going to join us. Now, John Mallin is somebody that probably very few people know, but John was the most senior civil servant responsible for Ofsted in the DfE when I was there. And I think John's view over time is that Ofsted's moved from an inspectorate inspecting and informing into a policy vehicle for the government. And actually, I remember when I was even when I was in Ofsted back 10 years ago, I often used to play the game with colleagues and say, well, what would you prefer? An Education Act or a framework? Which one would you go for? And often people say, well, and most people ignore Education Acts, to be honest. There's loads of bits of Education Act, like the 1944 one about collective acts of worship. You know, I mean, that's still a law, but you know, I mean, nobody's checking on it. But actually, the framework is something that you make a big difference very, very quickly. And if you get that wrong, then the impact is quite significant. I think the current framework is wrong, and I've felt that all along. And you know, I think that the big listener needs to make sure that it does get into the framework, and then it starts looking at the quality of the people that are inspecting against it. And I'm not sure that, you know, this idea that everyone's got to be inspected over a certain period of time. I think that's just making the inspection workforce work very hard. Actually, the quality of them, they're just bringing people in that aren't suited to do it. They shouldn't be doing it, you know, but they're running risk. The risk that they're running on a good framework is that you put rubbish people in doing the framework, inspecting against it, and then the whole thing falls down, you know. And actually, I think if you get the inspectors right, they can make a bad framework work, but can't do it the other way around, you know. At the heart of it, you know, you need to get your inspection workforce right, and I'm just not convinced that they've got them right. And I'd like to see much less inspection, much more focused inspection, where it can have a positive impact.
Think that's
Save the
training,
environment.
Frank, or a lack of a career, because it to be used to just be HMI, didn't it? If we go back a long time, HMI inspected, and there was a career path into HMI. Now, there isn't a career path into becoming an Ofsted inspector as such. It's an added extra, if you like, if you're head of a good or outstanding school. And I just wonder if the preparation to be an inspector is as thorough as maybe it used to be.
No, it's not. They've written about this that in fact we put it in the select committee submission that even when Stan and I worked, we had a year seconded to Ofsted in the mid-90s, and we had an HMI crawling all over us for that year, quality assured every single inspection that we're involved in. And it was the most impressive bit of professional development I think Stan and I had ever had. And then when I carried on doing a bit of inspection, and when I became an HMI in 2001, I wasn't let loose. I had a mentor for a year, you know, and it was not, it was about understanding the culture and how you resolve the issue that Stan mentioned, you know, that could pop up in an inspection. Well, how do you resolve that? Well, you know, there are a lot of people that simply just go, oh, well, the framework says we're going to do this. But actually, there's a professional judgment that's required at that point. And I think that that year gave me the opportunity to see a vast array of stuff that I'd never seen before. And all of that, I think, has just sort of meant that I'd had two professional development experiences with Ofsted, which were the highest quality, and they just don't get that now. They're in, inspectors are in, they do a couple of weeks training, they do a shadow, then they're signed off, they're off. You know, and the HMIs don't stay for any length of time at all. I mean, apparently the average length of time for an HMI now is 3 years.
Wow.
So it's seen as a stepping stone, isn't it, Stan? I think to to something else, trust CEO role, education director role in a trust or whatever. It's they're hemorrhaging all of the talent. They've lost a lot of good talent. A lot of expertise has left, because
I
they did.
think, sorry.
I could rabbit on for years about this. You carry on, Tracy.
Well, picking up on that point about sort of CPD, I think a lot of head teachers absolutely want somebody on their leadership team to have the insider knowledge, because that's a really valued kind of thing in schools, and that actually if we're gonna use this framework and go along with this process, that actually if I've got somebody on my leadership team who knows the ins and outs, who's been in those conversations as little as they are now, that can only be helpful. And actually, if you're an inspector coming in and you know that somebody is a peer of yours in the inspection process, you're probably likely to be a bit more aligned in your views about things. And I think picking up on something, Stan, you said about context, that's absolutely key, isn't it? Because I've met inspectors who have only come from a particular environment, who have no understanding of what it's like to work in one of the toughest sort of inner city schools, and think, crikey, this is mayhem around this place. What are you doing? The children are this and that, and you're like, actually, we're doing quite a good job. They're all in. They come in every day. We have all our systems in place to make sure that the support is put in where necessary. But we can't fix every single thing right now from the age for 11 to 16, and we play the long game. And if year seven are, doing these sorts of things, actually come and look at them when they're year 11 or year 13 and how transformational that experience has been. And I just find that a bit sad that sometimes you can't communicate with an inspector about the challenges you've already overcome to get where you are. And that feels a bit sort of demoralizing that you think, well, actually, you're still RI.
Yes.
And you're like,
And the
oh,
issue
I
that they
know
often
that.
throw at you, as soon as you say, ah, but these are sort of more challenging children, the issue they throw at you is you're putting a ceiling on these, no, I'm really not, but I can try as hard as I can to sprint, but I'm never going to beat Linford Christie, no matter how hard I try. But don't judge me on Linford Christie. Judge me on how much better I'm getting with my sprinting.
I articulating that actually is probably the most difficult thing. I remember doing a presentation for Northern Powers Partnership with a number of business leaders and local authority leaders in Bradford, and the CEO of Bradford Council sort of attacked me for suggesting that she said, I have this. I expect the same standards here as there is in Windsor and Maidenhead, which is my sort of standard local authority that I go to when I want to draw comparisons with those that have and those that don't. But I was trying to get across that I have really have got the expectations that kids in Bradford and other places can actually achieve as well as other kids that are a more favourable position. But actually, the reality of it is that there are more hurdles. There are the hurdles are higher and they're more frequent. And I think for me that children that do make it, they are, some of these are outstanding children, really, really amazing kids. And but because there are so many hurdles that unfortunately some kids can't get over the hurdles. And sometimes it's nothing to do with them, is it? And I think what was interesting today is the point I was going to make was the Kevin Collins article in the Times Education Supplement. Yeah, again, making the case that we're underestimating the current social fabric that young people are growing up in. And in a way, it was quite encouraging to hear. To read Sir Dan Moynihan, not somebody that I generally have favourable comments about, but saying that today, that actually there are just so many obstacles for young people. And in a way, spinning it back to inspection, unless you've got people inspecting who understand that and believe that, you're going to have a problem with your inspection workforce. You're going to get some judgments way wrong. And it, again, I feel as though it's all woven, Stan, because it is all around the context, isn't it?
I was just going to say, in probably misrepresenting Ken Robinson, it's also the fact that still the ultimate is to go to university, and we sort of focus everything for that. And unless you get to university somehow, you've been a failure. And I think we've got to rethink that as a country, to say, maybe getting a degree isn't the end of the education process. Maybe there are other exits that are just as valuable, and in fact, in some cases, probably a lot more valuable.
Do you know, one of the, this is a great thing about one of my successes this week, okay, and I've had quite an interesting, varied week this week, including sort of, trying to support somebody getting an honour. All right. So that was, I was really, it was a nice session yesterday trying to do that. But actually, my biggest achievement was actually making a pallet into a garden sort of plant stand yesterday, and that involved just using a jigsaw and a few nails and a drill. It actually it sort of summed up for me, what the sort of enjoyment of life, and what the meaning of life is, because I got much more enjoyment out of that than most of the other stuff that I'd done all week, and it was just a practical thing. My wife wanted it. I was giving pleasure to my wife, and it involves some sort of practical, handy stuff,
You didn't knock the nails in with the drill, did you, Frank, by the sound of
Oh, that's where it went wrong. Now, I have to say, it's not been tested yet. So the plants haven't gone in. The plants haven't been watered. So we'll see. I'll give you an update, Stan, in a couple of weeks as to whether or not that does withstand the pressure of planting. But
This is one of those terrible unintended consequences of a framework, isn't it?
it
Because
is.
you put the pressure on EBAC and you remove the investment in the arts and the tech. And I know several schools that don't have any tech equipment in schools.
I agree. I was shocked. I was so
None.
shocked. I went to a school in the Northeast and I saw a lathe. I nearly fell
Yeah.
over. I nearly
Yeah.
fell over.
Yeah, in the school I'm currently head at, we have the most amazing DT block. It's got two huge workshops. The students are constantly using the machines. Some I probably would be too scared to use myself. There's two huge food tech rooms. That there's all of that stuff. But equally down the road from where I am, there's an outstanding secondary school, hasn't got a single food tech room, DT room, or anything. And I think we are absolutely dispossessing young people as a consequence of the frameworks of being able to do stuff in life.
And the point is,
Or
Tracy,
not giving our talented musicians and artists the value that they deserve. I might not be very good at English, therefore I'm failing. The fact that I can play seven instruments and is irrelevant to that. And I'm biased. My son's a music teacher, so
But I mean, I've had the, I mean, I wrote to Teacher Tap. I wrote to Laura McInerney because I'd like to know the makeup of senior leadership teams now. What in secondary schools? What subject areas are they coming from?
I'm very, very lucky. I
You've got
really
a good
am.
range.
I've got DT, I've got science, I've got maths, I've
But
got
you've got
drama.
the you've got but you're committed to that, aren't you? Your
Yeah,
school,
absolutely.
your educational philosophy is that. But that school down the road, you're desperately trying to keep your head of maths. Oh well, we'll make you part of the senior leadership team. But the head of PE or the head of music, oh well, we don't do we have a sort of integrated arts program, so we don't actually have too much music going on. I find it all very quite depressing, to think that some subject areas have more opportunity for career growth than others. That's at the heart of it for me. And in a way, the framework promotes that.
Well, Michael Gove, wasn't it, who said, music wasn't academic enough to
God. I honestly, if you said that, anybody look at a bit of notation, musical notation. I mean, heaven help me. I mean,
Yeah.
oh my God, yeah.
I think it's about the hardest thing I've ever
It
tried
is,
to
yeah.
do.
And I mean, that guitar behind me, I mean, just I can play it, but actually, I'm now onto music notation. I've tried to avoid the theory for years, but now I'm into it. And oh wow, right, good chat.
Yeah.
Enjoy it. I enjoyed it. And I think we're back next week, Stan. I think we are. I can never
Yeah.
quite keep track of where we're up to because people, oh, that's right, because people sort of drop out and whatever. And so we then have to find replacements. But we, as I said before, we've got guests lined up now until September.
It's
So
amazing.
it is, I can't
Wow.
believe it. We do it,
Yes,
Stan.
can I?
And people phone me up and say, can I be on the Frankenstein chat? And we don't have massive viewing figures. It's really weird. Sometimes, like, we do, sometimes there's some that hit thousands, and there are others that hit 30. And the ones that hit 30, some of those are the best chats.
Yeah.
But anyway, you've been a great guest, Tracy. Thank you
Oh,
very much
thank
for
you
joining
very
us.
much for inviting me on.
Yeah,
It's been
no.
lovely to be here.
And we would love to catch up again in
Yeah.
2025 to see what impact
Yeah.
the big listeners had, and to sort of get
Absolutely.
your
Yeah. Watch
insight again. So,
the faces.
anyway, until next week, everybody, have a good week, and all being well, we'll see you then. Take care. Bye bye.
Great. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.